Good evening. Welcome to WCVE Forum. I'm Benjamin Dolly. Tonight, we hear Brookings Institute Senior Foreign Policy Fellow Bruce Riddell speaking on the topic of Pakistan, America, and the future of the global jihad. Mr. Riddell's speech to the World Affairs Council of Greater Richmond was recorded on February 17th at the Jefferson Hotel. He was introduced by Paul Levengood, President of the Virginia Historical Society and Board Member of the World Affairs Council.
Well, as a historian, I believe very strongly in the old line from Shakespeare's The Tempest, that what's past is prologue. And that is to say that in the past, in history, we can often find evidence that helps us make sense of the present and, hopefully, make informed decisions that will affect our future. So I was delighted when I picked up a copy of our speaker's most recent book and saw that it includes a fascinating and nuanced historical summary of the United States and one of its most important global relationships with the nation of Pakistan. In a concise, easy-to-understand fashion, Bruce Riddell traces seven decades of America's ties to Pakistan and the way that U.S. policies have helped encourage the establishment of military dictatorships in that country and, in fact, perhaps, foster the rise of Islamic extremism. Riddell describes the original democratic vision of Pakistan's engaging founder, Muhammad Jinnah, and he charts the waxing and waning of democracy and military dictatorship since 1947. Tellingly, he describes the historical precedent set for Pakistan during the years of Zia-ul-Haq to potentially become an Islamist state controlled today, in the future perhaps, by the Taliban or their ilk. And obviously that's distressing news. In Riddell's own words in Newsweek recently, quote, "In Pakistan, we now have, for the first time, the possibility of a jihadist state emerging. And a jihadist state in Pakistan would be America's worst nightmare in the 21st century." Pakistan, he argues, to use Thomas Jefferson's term, is the proverbial wolf by the ears for the U.S. Holding on is a frightening prospect, but we dare not let him go. Our speaker this evening is admirably suited to be presenting to us on this subject about which we all need to know more. Bruce Riddell has an undergraduate degree from Brown University, a master's in diplomatic history from Harvard, and he has studied in London at the Royal College of Defense Studies. Mr. Riddell has, it seems, a knack for being involved in the tumultuous issues of our day. He was working at the CIA's Iran desk at the time of the Islamic Revolution. He then shifted to the Egypt desk in 1981, just in time to presciently warn our government of the likelihood of Anwar Sadat's assassination and of Hosni Mubarak's likely rise to succeed him. So clearly this is a man who knows what he's talking about. And the residents of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue recognized that fact, so much so that he served as a senior advisor to four U.S. presidents on Middle East and South Asian issues. Under President Obama, he chaired an interagency review of policy toward Afghanistan and Pakistan and helped draft President Obama's 2009 speech referring to the Pakistan-Afghanistan border as the most dangerous region of the world. After his government service, Mr. Riddell's professional life has been spent at the Brookings Institution, where he's a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy. He's the author of another book, in addition to the one he's speaking on tonight, 2008's The Search for Al-Qaeda, Its Leadership, Ideology, and Future, as well as numerous journal and newspaper articles, and you can regularly find his work online on the Daily Beast. So please join me in a warm Richmond welcome for Bruce Riddell, who will speak to us on the topic, Deadly Embrace, Pakistan, America, and the Future of Global Jihad.
Thank you, Paul, for that very kind introduction. Thank you, Ruse, and everyone else involved in the World Affairs Council and making this event possible today. And thank all of you for showing up on such a beautiful winter's day in Richmond to talk about a subject which is not exactly one of the most uplifting that you're going to hear about this year. The timing of the World Affairs Council couldn't be better. It is almost exactly 2 years ago since President Obama called me at home and invited me to come in and chair the strategic review for his administration of American policy towards Afghanistan and Pakistan. And today, even as we speak, the relationship between the United States and Pakistan may be on the brink of its darkest moment in many, many years over the issue of the future of an American diplomat, Raymond Davis. We'll come to that in a little bit. It's important that I state clearly up front that while I did provide the chairmanship for the strategic review of the president's policy towards Afghanistan and Pakistan, and I did serve in his campaign as a volunteer advisor, I do not speak here tonight for the American administration or for the president. My views are solely my own and should not in any way be associated with the Obama administration. Let's start with the state of the American-Pakistani relationship today. There's an odd disharmony or disconnect in this relationship today. On the one hand, senior public officials on both sides in Washington and Islamabad will say publicly that the relationship is strong, it's important, and that we're engaging in ways we've never engaged before. And all that's true. For example, last December, when the president issued his latest update on his policy in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the part that dealt with Pakistan emphasized our unique strategic engagement with the Pakistani government over the last 2 years. That at every level of the American government, every level of the Pakistani government, we are now meeting and talking more seriously, more candidly, and more often than ever before. And yet, while that public display of harmony is there, right below the surface, and today, not even below the surface anymore, there's intense frustration on both sides. You can read it in the New York Times and in the Pakistani newspapers every single day. On the American side, there's the constant plate, do more. Pakistan needs to do more. It needs to do more about Al-Qaeda. It needs to do more about the Afghan Taliban. It needs to do more about human rights. It needs to do more about taxing its own people. The American administration has a long laundry list of things that Pakistan needs to do. On the Pakistani side, you hear equal frustration. The Chief of Army Staff, General Kayani, the most powerful man in Pakistan, was in Washington last fall. And when he went back to Pakistan, he told the Pakistani press he is the most bullied man in the world, that he'd come to Washington and been bullied by the American administration. Most bullied relationship in the world is not a term of endearment. This is not a saying, well, everything is just great in this relationship. And then last December, the CIA's top man in Afghanistan, the chief of station, was outed in the Pakistani press. That means they put his name out in the press. He had to be removed from the country literally overnight. The next day, the New York Times reported, citing senior sources in the CIA, that he'd been outed by Pakistan's intelligence service, the Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, or the notorious ISI. I spent 30 years in the intelligence business. I can tell you something. This is not normal in a liaison relationship, where you're outing each other in public and blaming each other for what's going wrong. That's not the way liaison relationships are supposed to work. And now, most recently, an American government employee, and that's about all we can say we know about him, Mr. Raymond Davis, shot to death two Pakistanis on the streets of Lahore, whom he believed were trying to rob him. A third Pakistani was killed in a traffic accident when other Americans tried to come to Mr. Davis's relief. And a fourth Pakistani, the widow of one of the two shot to death, committed suicide a few days later because she felt that her government wouldn't stand up to the United States of America. The United States has demanded Mr. Davis' release under terms of diplomatic immunity. Pakistan is saying, no, we have to investigate two cases of murder. The relationship now hangs in the balance. We just canceled a meeting of the U.S.-Afghanistan-Pakistan Trilateral Committee set up by the president 2 years ago to try to improve relations on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. President Zardari was due in Washington next month. That meeting is now in jeopardy. And President Obama, who has promised to go to Pakistan in 2011, that meeting, that visit, is also in jeopardy. And as bad as it is, if you listen carefully and read between the lines, there's all kinds of hints of much worse doom, that things could get a lot worse between the United States and Pakistan. For example, last May, a car bomb almost went off in Times Square. It was set by an American citizen of Pakistani origin, who was trained to build that car bomb in Pakistan by the Pakistani Taliban. Another mass casualty attack in the United States on the scale of 9/11, or let's say on the scale of Oklahoma City, that is postmarked Pakistan, is going to take this relationship to a place no one wants it to go. And if you don't know where that is, read Bob Woodward's book, because he tells you on page 150 or so that there are 300 targets already set by the United States military for bombing in Pakistan if there is a mass casualty attack in the United States of America. The specter of another mass casualty attack in India, like that that occurred in November of 2008 in Mumbai, also hangs constantly over this relationship. What would India do if there is another attack from Pakistan, like Mumbai? Would it turn the cheek again, or would it use force? And if it uses force, how do we keep two nuclear-armed countries from going to Armageddon? These doomsday prophecies are real. They're not inevitable. They don't have to happen, but they're real possibilities, and they hang over this relationship. The stakes could not be bigger. Pakistan today, in terms of population, is the sixth largest country in the world, roughly 185 million people. Even assuming a modest drop in fertility rates, within a decade, it'll be the fifth largest country in the world. Today, it is the second largest Muslim country in the world in terms of population. Within a decade, it'll be the largest Muslim country in the world, surpassing Indonesia. It is the first and so far only country created for the purpose of being a homeland for Muslims. It was one of the first countries created after World War II from the decolonialization of European empires. Today, it has the fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world. Pakistan's exact nuclear arsenal is a closely guarded secret. But somewhere in the neighborhood of 120 to 150 nuclear weapons. That means Pakistan is on the verge of becoming the fifth largest nuclear power in the world, surpassing the United Kingdom, and it's on a glide path that will make it, within a decade, the fourth largest nuclear power in the world, surpassing France. Only China, Russia, and the United States will have more nuclear weapons. And Pakistan probably has the dubious distinction of having more terrorists per square mile than any other country in the world. Al-Qaeda, Pakistan Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group that carried out the attack on Mumbai 2.5 years ago, all have their headquarters in Pakistan. When President Obama wrote 2 years ago that the Pakistan-Afghan tribal areas are the most dangerous in the world for America, that is what he was talking about. How did we get to this place? How did we get to a place which is as important and frightening as this? Well, that's what Deadly Embrace tries to explain. And it tries to explain how we got here by looking at three separate narratives and then seeing how they converge together to produce the situation we have today. The first narrative, or the first story, is the story of Pakistan's own internal development. How has Pakistan developed? How did it get started? What is the idea of Pakistan? The second story is the American relationship with Pakistan, our bilateral relationship with Pakistan over the last 60-some years. And the third narrative is the story of the growth of the global jihad. Global jihad is a term used in the American intelligence community to refer to the phenomenon we see now of a global jihadist movement, a movement that is not confined to any one country in the world, but is truly global in its scope and its outreach. Let me say a bit about each one of these three separate stories. First, the internal story. Pakistan was created in the 1940s by one of the most remarkable men of the 20th century, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, a man who dreamed of creating a Muslim state after he came to the conclusion that India would never treat Muslims as first-class citizens. But he was a very odd choice for this. Muhammad Ali Jinnah was more British than anything else. He wore beautiful Savile Row suits. He changed his tie every day and never wore the same tie twice, or at least that's what his biographers claim. He loved his martini at the end of the day, and he loved his cigarette with a British cigarette holder. He loved it so much, that's what killed him in the end. He could barely speak in Urdu, and when he gave speeches in Urdu, the crowd often didn't understand what he said. He could speak beautifully in English. He longed to be an English lawyer. He was trained in England as a lawyer, but he was never accepted in English society. His dream was a dream of England on the Indus River, a democratic, modern, more or less secular state. But that's not what happened. He died within a year of Pakistan's independence, and Pakistan in the years since has seen one military dictator after another, four so far. There's been a revolving door in Pakistani politics between weak and usually extremely corrupt civilian governments and strong and often corrupt military dictatorships. One of those military dictators, General Zia-ul-Huq, is properly called the grandfather of the modern global jihad. He created it in the 1980s with our cooperation in the war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. He took the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI, which until then had been a relatively small organization whose responsibilities were real intelligence, and made it into the gigantic organization it is today, which spies on every Pakistani and many others. When he came into office in 1978, it had 2,000 employees. When he died in 1988, it had 40,000 and a budget of over $1 billion a year. His death illustrates another factor of Pakistan's extraordinary internal story. Pakistani history is littered with murders and assassinations, and we don't know who did it. It's like an Agatha Christie novel over and over again, although Hercule Poirot never shows up in the last chapter to bring us all together and say, he did it. We never find that out. Most recent example, Benazir Bhutto. Probably Pakistan's most liberal, thoughtful leader ever was murdered. The UN investigation came to the conclusion it was probably Al-Qaeda, but we really don't know. So Pakistan's internal story is a story of several struggles. One struggle is between the secular democratic vision of its founder versus Islamic extremism. Another is the vision of its founder of a civilian democratic government and the reality of military dictatorships. One thing I really want to stress, though, about Pakistani internal politics, if you look at it over the course of the country's history, and that's this. The Pakistani people have shown a remarkable determination that they want freedom and they want democracy. Maybe not exactly like we think what freedom is and what democracy is. But they have not rested quietly under those four military dictators. This is not an Egypt which sat under Hosni Mubarak for 30 years, or a Tunisia that sat under Ben Ali for 35 years. This is a country which has fought its dictators. And in 2007 and 2008, the Pakistani people, led by Pakistani lawyers, rose up and demanded the dictator be thrown out and the rule of law and accountability be put in place. And that's an important thing to keep in the back of your mind. Unfortunately, it's also the segue to the second narrative, which is the U.S.-Pakistani relationship, because we have resisted them every time they have tried to fight for democracy, and we resisted it in 2007 and 2008. The U.S.-Pakistani relationship is like a roller coaster. It's had incredible highs and unbelievable lows. In the period of the highs, we give Pakistan billions of dollars in unaccountable funds. In the periods of lows, we sanction Pakistan and try and isolate it in the world community. And this up and down has gone on now for 45 years. If the U.S.-Pakistani relationship were a situation comedy or a drama on television, it would have number one ratings around the world. I guarantee it, because the highs are so high and the lows are so low, and there's so much pathos involved in it. The highs have been always built around some great secret project that actually remains a secret for not very long. In the 1950s and 60s, for example, Pakistan was the base from which we flew U-2 flights over the Soviet Union, our most important intelligence collection effort at that point in the Cold War. Until, of course, one of them was shot down. Then the whole world found out what anyone who lived in Pakistan already knew. There was an American military base on the outskirts of Peshawar that looked a lot like American suburbia transplanted into Pashtunistan. After that came the great secret project of Nixon's trip to China, which was based out of Pakistan. And then the great secret war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, which anyone who watched 60 Minutes could find out all the details about what the war was going on almost from the day it began. And most recently, the great war against Al-Qaeda. What is remarkable about this history of American support for dictatorship in Pakistan is that it's one of the most bipartisan things in American foreign policy. Republicans and Democrats alike have loved Pakistani military dictators, and Republicans and Democrats alike have done very, very little to help the democratically elected civilian governments. The Eisenhower administration loved Pakistan's first military dictator, Ayub Khan. John F. Kennedy loved him even more. John F. Kennedy loved Ayub Khan so much, he hosted him for a state dinner at Mount Vernon, our first president's home, the only time in the history of Mount Vernon it's ever been used to host a state dinner with a foreign visitor. The next time you go to Mount Vernon, look in the visitor center, and you'll see great pictures of JFK and Jackie with Ayub Khan. The Johnson administration turned its back on Pakistan. The Reagan administration re-embraced it with an enthusiasm that was remarkable. General Zia-ul-Huq was President Reagan's favorite leader in the Muslim world. The first Bush administration and the Clinton administration wanted to be friends of Pakistan, but ended up sanctioning Pakistan left and right for the development of a nuclear weapons program, which the Reagan administration had turned a blind eye to. And the second Bush administration found in Musharraf a match made in heaven. We ended up giving Musharraf something like $12 billion over the course of 8 years. The reason I say something like $12 billion is because nobody really knows in the United States government how much money we gave. That's how unaccountable it was. The third narrative is the narrative of the global jihad, a movement, an idea that began in Pakistan in the 1980s in the war against the Soviet Union. And don't get me wrong. I think what we did in the 1980s with the Mujahideen to the Soviet Union was a good thing. We brought down communism. We brought down the Berlin Wall. But we took our eye off the ball as soon as that happened in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and that helped contribute to the disaster we have today. I profile in Deadly Embrace a Palestinian who's probably not well known to you, named Abdullah Azzam. Abdullah Azzam is one of the most critical figures of our contemporary time. He's almost completely unknown. It is Abdullah Azzam who first formulated the notion of global jihad, that the enemy of the Islamic world, as he sees it, is not the repressive governments that hold Muslims in dictatorship. They're pawns. And it's not really Israel, which is a pawn too. The real enemy is you, Crusaders, Americans, and the Soviets. And by the end of the 1980s, he'd knocked off one and was turning to another. Abdullah Azzam has the remarkable pedigree of being the founder of three terrorist organizations. He was co-founder with Osama bin Laden of the Services Bureau in the 1980s, an organization to assist Arabs going to fight the Soviet Union. The Services Bureau is the beginning of Al-Qaeda, so he deserves credit for being a co-founder of Al-Qaeda. He was also co-founder of Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group I mentioned earlier that attacked Mumbai in 2008, and he was a founder of Hamas, the terrorist organization that controls Gaza today and which has sent dozens of suicide bombers to create mayhem in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. These three narratives have had the unfortunate effect of creating the situation we have today. And the situation we have today is indeed dire. Paul mentioned it in the introduction. It is conceivable to say to think the unthinkable, a Pakistan which could become a jihadist state, actually taken over by jihadists. As I mentioned, General Zia-ul-Huq was a jihadist. We were fortunate in the 1980s that the Soviet Union was his target. Bad news, no Soviet Union anymore. We're the only target left. It is not inevitable. It is not imminent, it is not the most likely outcome, but it is possible for the first time to conceive of a Pakistan which is a jihadist state with the fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world. And when you talk about that, you will always hear those who say, but if that happens, we'll do something to secure Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. I got bad news for you. If you think that's possible, you need to stop reading so many Tom Clancy novels. It is not possible. That is a fairy tale. We do not know where their nukes are, and they will fight to protect them. That is not a realistic option. So what is to be done? Well, here I'm going to obviously give a teaser. That's the last chapter of the book, and I don't want to tell you the outcome. Otherwise, you won't read the book. But I will talk about one or two things. My first point is this. Apply the Hippocratic Oath. Do no more harm. The history of U.S.-Pakistani relations demonstrates one thing. We can make a bad situation worse, and we have made a bad situation worse. And embracing every military dictator in Pakistan has made a bad situation worse. If civil-military relations in Pakistan today are in a very bad place, it's partly our fault. Not all our fault, but partly our fault. So don't do any more harm to this system. Support the civilian, democratically elected process, even as it produces leaders who are corrupt. Let's be honest with ourselves. We've had a few of those we've elected ourselves in the United States. It happens. That's how democracy works. Rarely do you get Thomas Jefferson's and John Adams, James Monroe all at one time. And even then, they had Aaron Burr. And that's what we have in Pakistan today, Aaron Burr. But they are still the results of a democratically elected process, and we need to work through those people. That doesn't mean ignore the military. It means always remember who should be in charge. Don't link ourselves to any single Pakistani politician or general. Support a system, a process, the process we believe in at home, we should support there. The second thing I think we need to do is to think about Pakistan in its regional setting. Pakistan needs to be seen in the setting where it sits between Afghanistan and Iran on one side and India on another. The president 2 years ago created the Afghanistan-Pakistan Special Representative. That was a smart move in that it recognized you could not win the war in Afghanistan, whatever winning means, without thinking about Pakistan. But it was a half step, because you cannot possibly hope to change Pakistan without dealing with the issue that obsesses Pakistanis, and especially Pakistani generals, and that is India. We need to think about this region holistically. We need to support a big idea, a very big idea. And that idea is rapprochement in South Asia, the development of a détente between India and Pakistan. These are two of the fastest growing countries in the world. India will be the largest country in population in our lifetimes. It has one of the fastest growing economies. Pakistan's economy is not growing as well, but it could. If they could work together, they could build a South Asia that would be remarkable and do remarkable things. But they are divided by deep historical divisions. But those divisions can be addressed. Pakistan's last military dictator, General Pervez Musharraf, sought to address them. In the last days and years of his term in office, he engaged in secret negotiations with India, which came very, very close to resolving their differences. Steve Cole, one of America's finest journalists, has written about it in The New Yorker. I interviewed General Musharraf. I've interviewed the Indians. They all agree we're very, very close to a breakthrough that could have put India and Pakistan on a very different trajectory. The challenge is to get back there, to find a way to help these two countries live in harmony and in peace. I'll give you just one example of how dysfunctional their relationship is today. If you want to fly from India to Pakistan, you can't get there on a direct flight. There aren't direct flights. You have to go to Doha or Dubai or Kathmandu or someplace else. That's not normal. That's not healthy. But if you put the entrepreneurs of Pakistan and India together, they will defeat terror, just as it's been defeated in other places. This hasn't been the most uplifting talk you've ever gone to, but I do want to end on this positive note, because lost in all the news last week about Mr. Davis, about riots here, there, and everywhere, is the news that 2 years after Mumbai, India and Pakistan have agreed to resume their dialogue and to talk to each other again. It's a very, very big step. What the United States needs to do is support that. But we got to do it in a way that's different than we normally do diplomacy. Not with a big, high visibility envoy who gives a press conference every day. That won't work. That will drive the Indians especially absolutely berserk. We've got to do it with subtlety, sophistication, and under the radar. Now, when I say this, many times people look at me and say, yeah, but we're Americans. And I say, let's lift up our game and try and see if we can do something in South Asia in a different way that's good for Indians, Pakistanis, Afghans, Kashmiris, and above all, in our own national interest. Thank you very much for your attention. I look forward to your questions.
Now we're in a different room, but the procedure is the same. If you have a question, please come to the microphone in the middle. Mr. Riddell will recognize you. And please, as we always say, please make it a question. We don't need a stem winder of a speech. Please make it a question. Let him have something to answer and then give the floor to the next person.
Several weeks ago, a very liberal governor in Pakistan was assassinated by one of his guards for blasphemy. And you mentioned the fact that in the uprising against Musharraf, lawyers played an important role. After the assassin was arrested, lawyers, among other people, came out in his support. This, of course, seems to be a direct contradiction to what you would expect of lawyers who are interested in the rule of law. And how do you see this kind of development affecting the internal development of Pakistan?
The assassination of Salman Taseer is a graphic demonstration of what's going on in Pakistan today. There is a struggle, a violent struggle, between those who still believe Jinnah's vision of a moderate, secular, modern, democratic Pakistan, and those who have a different vision, and their vision is of an Islamist state, a jihadist state. Pakistan today is in the extraordinary position of being a country which is both a patron state sponsor of terror and a great victim of terror. Pakistani intelligence service has close links with the Afghan Taliban. It created Lashkar-e-Taiba and still harbors it. But is it also at war with the Pakistan Taliban? This illustrates one of the reasons why Pakistan is so difficult for Americans to get their heads around. It's a contradiction within a contradiction within a contradiction. And the murder of the governor of Punjab was the most graphic illustration of that. He is an outspoken advocate of human rights. He's married to an Indian woman and had been an advocate of Indo-Pak rapprochement. He was killed by his own bodyguard for his views. And many lawyers did come out and support the assassin. But many other Pakistanis have come out and support Mr. Taseer. This battle, this is a battle right now, is a battle for the soul of Pakistan. One of Pakistan's leading advocates of human rights, Ms. Sheri Rahman, formerly Minister of Information, has publicly been identified by the dark forces in Pakistan as the next target for assassination, and she is living in underground today. This isn't easy. But we have a clear interest in seeing how the outcome prevails, in seeing that the forces that do not want to turn Pakistan into a jihadist state prevail. There are many, many things we can do to help them. I'm going to mention just one more before I take the next question. It's really simple. Trade. Trade does a lot more than foreign assistance. Pakistan produces textiles. Pakistani textiles are taxed by our government at twice the rate Chinese or Indian textiles. That's to protect the textile industry in the United States. We need to change that. We should make Pakistani textiles as easy to buy in the United States as Chinese. That would help Pakistani entrepreneurs that would help Pakistani women. Simple things like that can do an awful lot.
How can India and Pakistan agree to settle the Kashmir problem?
The answer to that is, what is it that they almost agreed to in 2006 and 2007? General Musharraf and Prime Minister Singh, he's still Prime Minister of India, agreed on a formula that went roughly like this. The ceasefire line between India and Pakistan and Kashmir that divides the province of Kashmir, called the line of control, would be turned into an international border. At the same time, it would be turned into a permeable border, allowing Kashmiris to move back and forth with almost complete ease. Think of it like driving between Maryland and Virginia, something like that. In this way, India's territorial integrity would be respected. Pakistan would be able to say it had fulfilled its mission of helping the Muslims of Kashmir, and the biggest winner would be the Kashmiri people, who would actually be freed from the nightmare that they've been stuck in for the last 40 years. Now, Pervez Musharraf was no Mahatma Gandhi. He was no Nelson Mandela. He arrived at this formula after first trying nuclear blackmail, major terrorist attacks on India, and a limited war. So he's a slow learner, but he got to the right outcome. The tragedy is, by the time he got to the right outcome, his sell-by date in Pakistan had expired, and the Pakistani people were sick of him. But the idea that he promoted and that the Indians were willing to sign on to is still fundamentally a good idea. In many ways, it's a little bit like the Irish solution. You respect the border between Ulster and Ireland, but most issues become all Irish issues. Roughly, that's what this idea has. It could work like all tough conflicts. The biggest problem isn't figuring out what works. It's summoning the political will to get you there. In the Pakistani case, that means fighting the dark forces in Pakistan who do not want to go there. And it will take a very brave Pakistani leader to get us there. In the Indian side, I am convinced, and I know it for a fact because I've talked to him, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh kicks himself in the butt every night saying, I should have taken that deal, I should have taken that deal, I should have taken that deal.
Many people think of the only important reason for the United States to be to continue its involvement in Afghanistan is because of the importance of Pakistan. What, speaking as a private citizen and scholar, not for the Obama administration, what changes would you recommend for the U.S. towards Afghanistan to push us closer to your vision for our relationship with Pakistan?
The question is, what about Afghanistan? What should we do in Afghanistan different than what we are doing today? What are we doing? I hope you want to say what we're doing right and what are we doing wrong as well. Let me step back for you for a minute. When President Obama inherited the war in Afghanistan, he inherited a disaster, a war which we were on the verge of losing. In my report to the president, the opening statement is, we are about to lose the war in Afghanistan, but it is not yet lost. By every measure, casualties, attacks, you name it, the Taliban were winning and were close to taking over at least the southern half of the country. The president faced the problem of catastrophic defeat facing us in the eye. If the Taliban had succeeded, if we had cut and run, not just Afghanistan would be affected, but the entire Islamic world, and nowhere more importantly than in Pakistan. And you're absolutely right. A great deal of why we are in Afghanistan today is to try to impact the situation in Pakistan next door. The strategy the president has embarked upon is always focused on how many troops. But it's not just about troops. What we're trying to do in Afghanistan is much more than a military operation. It involves the kind of grand diplomacy I'm talking about. But the first thing you have to do when you're on the verge of defeat is change momentum. Nobody's going to talk about diplomacy when everybody thinks you're about to lose. And frankly, the administration made its situation worse in December of 2009 when the president announced the July 2011 notional date for a drawdown. I understand why he did it, but nobody in Afghanistan and Pakistan understood it. They all saw the Americans are going to cut and run, and they're going to leave in July 2011. That undermined our approach terribly. Every Afghan figured, you know, all I got to do is keep my eye on the clock, and the Americans will be gone. And every Pakistani general who's seen this movie before, where America cuts and runs, said, I've seen this, Charlie Wilson's War, Part 3. The administration has now walked that back. We're not talking about 2011. General Petraeus believes he is making progress in southern Afghanistan. My own view is it's too early to tell. Afghanistan is a unique war in many ways. One of its most unique attributes is this is a war Americans have actually fought twice. In the 1980s, I was part of the CIA teams that fought this war from Pakistan. We thought up all kinds of great ways to make life living hell for the Soviet 40th Red Army, and we succeeded. We know one thing, if you have a base in Pakistan, it's a lot easier to win. Now we're on the other side, and we're trying to deal with the problem of a base in Pakistan. We also know that this is a war that is a climate cycle. People don't fight in Afghanistan in February. You struggle to stay alive in Afghanistan in February. By this summer, General Petraeus's approach should either be showing signs of progress or not. I hope it shows signs of progress. If it does, then we know we're on a course that can lead us to an acceptable outcome, and I'm going to define acceptable outcome in a minute. We may not know exactly how long it will take, but we will know things are moving in a direction that is radically different than what the president inherited 2 years ago. If it's not working, we'll also know that. And then we're going to have to figure out a new strategy. And that's going to be very difficult to come up with. What is an acceptable outcome? It's not Switzerland. We are not going to build Switzerland in the Hindu Kush. We're not going to build Virginia in the Hindu Kush. We are going to try to build an Afghanistan which is strong enough and cohesive enough that it can deal with Al-Qaeda and with the true believers in the Taliban who are not interested in a political process, and that may be an awful lot of the Taliban. We don't know yet. With American experts and American financial support, and NATO experts and NATO financial support, but without American combat troops and without NATO combat troops. It'll be a lot cheaper than what we're doing today. I can't help but tell you one vignette. I briefed President Obama on Air Force One on a flight to California in March of 2009 on the strategic approach that we came up with. And I gave him one number to wrap his head around. It costs $250,000 to send an American soldier to Afghanistan for 1 year. Most of that is not his pay, as anyone who's ever served in the United States military knows. You do not get $250,000 a year. All that money is the cost of sending a soldier to the far side of the planet to a landlocked country with no oil. You think your gasoline prices are high? You know how expensive it is to get a gallon of gasoline to Kabul? It's about $40. That's expensive. It costs $12,000 to put an Afghan soldier on the battlefield per per year in 2008. If we doubled their pay to $25,000, which we have done, retention rates went from 40% to 90%. It's called capitalism. It's not rocket science. You pay people more, they will come to work. At $25,000 versus $250,000, you don't have to have a PhD in political economics to figure out what the right answer is. And that's the approach we are trying to work in Afghanistan. Build up the Afghan forces so they can replace us.
Hi, two quick questions. The first one is on global jihad. And I just wanted to know your opinion about the global jihad movement, which is essentially a theological war against the West. And would that be fair to say that the West response should be against these terrorists? The second question is, since it's a fact that Pakistani army control the entire new infrastructure in Pakistan, if any of that thing ever materialized where Pakistani state has to sign off on some kind of a peace deal, the army would rather leak nukes to terrorists than to sign off on any kind of peace deal. That will be kind of detrimental to army, because army's sole reason to exist is to basically create war against India. So.
I'm going to flip them in order and start with the second question. You are absolutely right. Pakistani army has vested interests in continuing the confrontation with India. Pakistani army has benefited enormously from the four military dictatorships and this sense of confrontation. Pakistani army is the largest single landholder in the country today. It has the only health insurance system that works in Pakistan. But I go back to my example, General Musharraf. You're not going to find a more India-centric, India-hating general than Pervez Musharraf. And yet he came around to the view that Pakistan's future has to be to get out of being in confrontation with India. Pakistan's generals are not stupid. They can be influenced. And they can be influenced by Pakistani politicians and Pakistani entrepreneurs who say, we want to have a different kind of Pakistan. It won't be easy. That's why the battle for the soul of Pakistan is underway. Question about radical Islam and global jihad. Let's start with a very important realization. At the height of Osama bin Laden's popularity, he was supported by a tiny minority in the Islamic world. The vast majority of Muslims have always rejected al-Qaeda's violent terrorism. And they've come to reject it even more in the years since September 11th, as al-Qaeda has killed more and more Muslims in Iraq, in Saudi Arabia, in Yemen, in Pakistan, and around the world. And what we have seen in this last winter is something that is really, really important. We have seen first in Tunisia and now in Egypt a revolution. It was a revolution not about al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's been sitting on the margins in this thing. I'll illustrate that in a minute. It's been a revolution of Twitter, not terror. Mass-based politics in the streets. The young refusing to use violence and creating regime change. This is scary. Change is always scary. It's unpredictable. We don't know how this is going to end. But right now, one of the biggest losers is al-Qaeda. They've been marginalized in this. They had nothing to do with this. They said regime change will never come in Egypt until the far enemy, the Crusaders, are defeated. Came with us actually helping bringing about regime change. Maybe not as enthusiastically as we should have, but with our help. Their narrative doesn't add up anymore. Proof? Ayman Zawahiri, the Egyptian who is number two in al-Qaeda, who used to speak out every week At one point, I used to call him the chatty caddy of international terrorism. He had a commentary on everything. He hadn't said a word. I know he'll say something sooner or later. He'll claim credit for it. But he knows the truth. He's been marginalized in this. In that sense, what you talked about, the battle within Islam, it's happening right now. And history is moving forward, and that is something to be encouraged about. It's not moving as quickly in Pakistan, but it's moving there too.
Okay. Hello, this is Patrick Coggan from the University of Richmond. Sir, in discussing our future American foreign policy in regards to Pakistan, you bring up a guiding principle of do no harm. But do you believe that recent increase in drone strikes and American covert operations inside the border of Pakistan has done tremendous harm in terms of public opinion in Pakistan against America? Thank you.
The question has to do with the CIA drone operations in Pakistan. Drone operations are a classic example of the contradictions of Pakistan. The drones are flown from a base in Pakistan. That's not a secret. The London Sunday Times 2 years ago published a satellite photograph of a base in Pakistan, and you didn't have to be a trained photo interpreter. You could see the drones were on the base. Pakistan and the United States collaborate in identifying the targets, not always smoothly and harmoniously. The recent friction you've seen in the CIA-ISI relationship demonstrates is not a love affair, but it is a working affair. The drones antagonize Pakistanis. Who wouldn't be antagonized? A foreign country is killing people on your territory from 30,000 feet in the sky. Your government is collaborating in it and refuses to admit it. The president was faced with a very tough choice on this. When he came into office, we were putting no pressure on Al-Qaeda, zero, zip, near thing, and hadn't been for several years. The drones put pressure on Al-Qaeda. One of the reasons why Ayman Zawahiri is not chatty-catty anymore, he's worried about where the next Hellfire missile is going to come. It works, but it's a tactic. It's not a strategy, and it has counterproductive elements. This is, if you were wanted to teach a course at the JFK School or at the University of Richmond in politics and foreign policy decision-making, here's the real thing. You got one way of putting pressure on Al-Qaeda, and it drives the Pakistani people crazy. What's the balance? And how do you get that balance right? And how do you fulfill your responsibility as President of the United States? It's a tough choice. We need to be very careful. We should not become drone addicted. The drones are not the solution. They're a tactic. They're not the solution. But they are a very effective tactic, and this is the real world, and on this one, I should be fully candid. I am a supporter. I was a supporter, an enthusiastic supporter of increasing drone operations. It's the only way we have right now of putting pressure on Al-Qaeda, but never, ever come to the conclusion they are the end state that will win this war. They're just a very neat platform. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to an address by Bruce Riddell to the World Affairs Council of Greater Richmond. The speech was recorded on February 17th. The views expressed on the WCVE forum are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the management and staff of WCVE Public Radio.